Our final speaker of the whole school is Matthew Fisher from UC Santa Barbara, and he'll be telling us about entanglement in hybrid quantum circuits. And Yaodong Li, also from UCSB, will be helping out with the Q&A. Matthew, please go ahead.
Okay, Tim, thank you so much, and thanks to all of the organizers for what has been a wonderful summer school. I've really enjoyed it and felt I've learned a lot already. And what I'm going to be talking about is a little bit different than almost all of the talks, except perhaps some parts of John McGreevy's and Frank Polman's. So the title of my talk is Entanglement in Hybrid Quantum Circuits. And what I'm interested in here is systems that are in the thermodynamic limit, quantum systems in the thermodynamic limit, which are open, non-equilibrium, dynamical, and exhibit interesting quantum phases and phase transitions. So that's a pretty big mouthful, open, non-equilibrium, dynamical, quantum phases and transitions. And in particular, what will be the central player is interesting transition that we've been playing around with called the measurement-driven entanglement transition. Okay, so let me see, I'm not being able to advance. Okay. So the ultra-quantum matter school and much of the work in the ultra-quantum matter conglomerate, if you will, has involved mostly equilibrium problems. And the focus of the school has, for example, been on quantum systems in equilibrium, ground states of quantum systems, exotic order, topological and fracton order, quantum criticality of various guises. And these are the fields of condensed matter theory and high energy theory. And in general, one is looking at, large quantum systems in the thermodynamic limit. Now, in the field of quantum matter or quantum physics, there are some other topics, of course, which I've listed here. There are non-equilibrium quantum systems. There are open quantum systems. There are quantum systems where the roles of the measurements and the observer is playing an important role. And historically, this has been in the field of quantum information theory. And quantum information theory has usually been looking at few body problems, partly because the some of the systems are, like the quantum computers, don't have many qubits at this stage. But in this talk, I want to, in some sense, combine these two areas. So I want to talk about quantum phases and transitions, which are going to be driven by measurements, in open non-equilibrium systems, which are in the thermodynamic limit. And the common thread which is tying all of this together is entanglement entropy. Now, let me first just mention thermal entropy, which is something that's familiar to all of us in equilibrium. So if we have a system of size L to the D, which is in thermodynamic equilibrium with a bath at temperature KBT, we can work in terms of the mixed state density matrix, e to the minus beta h, which we can write out in an eigenstate basis in this way. And if we compute the entropy, the thermal entropy, trace of rho log rho, that in general, at finite temperature at least, will be extensive. So it will scale as L to the d. Here, d will be the dimensionality of space. And the entropy is basically from state counting. It counts the number of states that are accessible at that temperature. But what I want to focus on really is entanglement entropy, and that's, has been discussed quite a bit this week. So rather than a system in thermodynamic equilibrium, we're considering a quantum system with a single eigenstate psi, constructing a pure state density matrix, rho, psi, psi. And to get the entanglement entropy, we bipartition the system into regions A and B, and talk about the entanglement between A and B by looking at the reduced density matrix on A by tracing out the degrees of freedom in B. And the entanglement entropy, as probably most of you know, is given by then trace A, rho A log rho A. And this gives us a measure of how the quantum mechanical degrees of freedom in the region A are entangled with those in region B. Now, at the risk of being slightly, you know, Let me just review a little bit of some of the things that have been discussed already, which is the spatial scaling of the entanglement entropy. So as Frank Polman was emphasizing, if one's looking at ground states, which are gapped ground states will generally have an area law. So the entanglement entropy will vary as L to the D minus one. So in two spatial dimensions, it would be the entanglement would just be across the cut. Now one does have gapless ground states, which often have area law entanglement entropy, but also can have log enhancement. So examples include one-dimensional conformal field theories or Fermi liquids, in which the entanglement entropy has, in addition to the area law piece, L to the D minus one, a multiplicative log L piece. But in any way, in any event, the ground states are not actually very entangled, and they manifest spatial locality. And so if you're deep within this region A, you don't really have much information about the region B. What I want to focus on now and for the moment is excited states with finite energy density. So you have a Hamiltonian with its ground state, and then you have many, many excited states. And I want to go to excited states which are sufficiently high that the energy density above the ground state is finite. And generically, such eigenstates will have volume law entanglement entropy with some entanglement entropy density a little less. And so these finite energy density eigenstates are very, very entangled. They're, you know, very non-local, and local information has been in these states spread out across the whole system. So there really isn't much local information that's accessible. But what I want to focus on in the talk is dynamics and dynamics out of equilibrium. So first, let me discuss entanglement dynamics out of equilibrium in closed systems. So one place where this has been looked at is in what's called quantum quenches, where one starts with some set of qubits in an unentangled initial state, maybe a direct product state, and evolves that state with a Hamiltonian. Here I've shown the Hamiltonian for a one-dimensional transverse fieldizing model with a longitudinal field. And if one integrates the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, as done by Kim and Hughes, and looks at the entanglement entropy between one half of the system and the other half for different system sizes, what one finds is that the entanglement spreads ballistically. Entanglement grows very, very rapidly. And even though, because energy is conserved, because one has Hamiltonian dynamics, energy will diffuse generally, the entanglement spreads much quicker than the energy. And now another system where one can look at the spread of entanglement are quantum circuits, which encode unitary dynamics, like the Hamiltonian dynamics, except with no energy conservation. So what's shown here is a quantum circuit with a bunch of qubits along here, time running in this direction, and these red blobs are two-qubit unitary gates. And so one can take this quantum circuit, evolve the qubits, the initial state of the qubits, with these random unitary gates. And if one starts in an unentangled product state, one again will find that the entanglement spreads ballistically, and at long times, one goes into a maximally entangled state. In fact, at long times, the state will essentially look like a random wave function with volume law entanglement entropy, maximum volume law entanglement entropy. So entanglement just tends to grow when one is out of equilibrium. And I'm interested in how to control entanglement entropy growth. I mean, the world around us isn't really that in high entropy. You know, life is a low entropy state of matter. And so I'm, you know, been very interested in a number of years about how to control entropy growth or entanglement entropy growth. And the way I'm gonna focus on here in this talk is via measurements and look at this measurement driven entanglement transition. So, I don't know what's going on here. So I want to mention something about entanglement and measurements. So imagine Alice and Bob in quantum information theory, our two favorite characters, who share a singlet state, up, down, minus, down, up. If you compute the entanglement entropy of Alice to Bob, one finds that because it's a pure state, that that's equal to S, the entanglement of entropy of Bob with Alice and given by log 2. So that's the maximum entropy, maximum entanglement entropy. But now what happens if Alice measures her spin? Okay, she makes a projective measurement on a spin, and there's two outcomes. She can either find her spin to be up over here, or she can find her spin to be down. Now, post-measurement, if one has the collapse of the wave function, which is what a projective measurement does, Alice then, the full wave function is now a direct product of Alice up, Bob down, or in the other outcome, Alice spin down and Bob spin up. But in either case, after the measurement, one has a direct product state and there's no entanglement left between Alice and Bob. So before measurement, they were in Alice and Bob's quantum systems were entangled, but after measurements, the entanglement has disappeared. They're no longer entangled. And so one has this thing that local measurements generally will induce disentanglement. Now, when one starts measuring a system, one has really thinking about an open quantum system. And since I'll be talking about open quantum systems, I want to mention two classes of such open quantum systems and to distinguish the more common one from the one I'm going to be focusing on. So in the first instance, one has a quantum system, maybe spins in a solid, which are coupled to a bath of phonons, for example. And if one imagined that one could turn on that coupling at some initial time and start with an initial pure state of the spins, then the initial pure density matrix becomes mixed. And in some sense, the environment is making measurements of the system, but the results of those measurements are lost. One has no information about what's going on in the environment. And this leads to what's called decoherence. And if one wants to look at the dynamics of such mixed state density matrix, they evolve with certain equations. One common one in the Markovian limit is called the Lindblad equation. But what I want to be talking about is another class of open systems, a system in which the system is monitored by an observer. So here we start the system in an initial pure state, and the observer makes a measurement, a projective measurement, so the system stays in a pure state. And the observer keeps track of a sequence of measurements that they're making, and so the wave function, as it evolves in time, stays as a pure state. And the dynamics in this case, in this second open system, the monitored system, the dynamics is described in terms of wave functions, which are undergoing some quantum trajectories. The particular quantum trajectory that the wave function undergoes depends on the outcome of the measurements that are being made. And it's in this second column, monitored systems, which is where the measurement-driven entanglement transition exists, and it doesn't exist as an interesting transition or at all in the more conventional open quantum system. So then I'll be interested in extended systems with measurements, that is monitored extended systems. And the simplest model that we can write down, which will capture that physics, is one of these hybrid quantum circuits. So it's a quantum circuit, which consists of qubits moving in time, which are acted on by both unitary gates. Here, these are two qubit unitary gates, but also are punctuated in the space-time a manifold by projective measurements. So as I've already mentioned, unitary evolution induces entanglement growth, ballistic entanglement growth, whereas measurements disentangle, they induce disentanglement. So in general, one would expect there would be a competition between unitary evolution and measurements. And it's this competition which can lead to interesting new physics. And we're going to explore this competition by following the wave function quantum trajectory as these qubits pass through this circuit. Now, here are some references. This is a relatively new area. My collaborators, from which I've learned everything I know about this topic, are Yaodong Li, who's a graduate student at UCSB, and he's a co-chair and will be answering all the questions you might have. And Xiao Chen, who was a postdoc at the KITP and is now on the faculty at Boston College. So again, a hybrid quantum circuit. So a hybrid quantum circuit, just to specify the one that we'll be looking at, we start with an initial density matrix, a pure density matrix, we implement these two qubit unitaries, which evolves the system temporally, and make these red 1-qubit measurements. So under a measurement, the density matrix is transformed in this way, where P plus or minus are projection operators. Here, these projection operators are measuring the Z component of the spin of a single qubit. And the measurement outcomes occur with probability trace P rho P. So what's important to emphasize here is I'm not summing over the measurement outcomes. We're going to choose one of the measurement outcomes, either upspin or downspin, chosen randomly from the probability of finding an upspin outcome or a downspin outcome, which depends on what the density the state of the density matrix. So the canonical model, which I'm going to then be looking at really in the rest of the lecture, are randomly chosen 2-qubit unitaries and single qubit measurements. And these single qubit measurements we're going to make with probability P. So here P is not the probability of an outcome of a quantum measurement. P is the probability that we choose to make a measurement. So for example, at this spot, we're not making a measurement, and that's with probability 1 minus P. And this red dot here, we're making a measurement at probability P. So we're basically decorating the quantum circuit with probability P of making single qubit measurements. So in this model, there's essentially just a single important parameter, little p, which runs between 0 and 1. Okay, so what is the phase diagram for this hybrid circuit? So let's just make simple arguments and try to guess what it might be. So imagine it's starting in an initial state, rho 0, psi 0, initial pure state, let's say is unentangled. We run the circuit dynamics to long times. And because of the way we're doing these projective measurements, the density matrix stays pure as given by psi t at time t. And at some late time, we want to interested in the entanglement entropy of some subregion A of these qubits, SA of t. So what is the expected phase diagram? Well, let's consider the two limits. P equals 0 is a limit where no measurements are made. And that's, in this case, the circuit reduces to that of a random unitary circuit. And as I already mentioned, one goes into a rapidly, ballistically, into a volume law entangled state. When P is 1, we're making projective measurements on every qubit on every time slice. And though making it every measurement, measuring every qubit at every time slice projects the qubits into a direct product state, up, down, down, up, down, up, let's say. And this leads to very low entanglement or no entanglement at all, Marley and area law state. The mystery and the curious thing is what happens at intermediate values of P between these two limits of pure unitary dynamics over here and the limit where one's making many, many projective measurements on this side. And the real question is there a transition between an entangled phase, a volume law entangled phase, and some sort of area law disentangled phase at a critical value of P sub C? If there is, and as we'll see from numerical simulations and other arguments, we can show that there is, this is what we call an entanglement transition. And again, I should emphasize that we have really an open monitored system dynamically evolving. It's in the thermodynamic limit, and it's going to have a interesting quantum non-equilibrium phases as well as interesting entanglement transition. Now, these hybrid circuits are quite complicated, and one way that progress has been made is just doing numerical simulations on these hybrid circuits. Now, a direct simulation is very challenging for large L, where L is the number of qubits, since the Hilbert space dimension grows as 2 to the L and it becomes rapidly inaccessible to even, you know, the best, biggest classical computers. And so what we have done is employ some quantum information technology which are using so-called stabilizers to encode special code word quantum states. And We're going to evolve those stabilizers with a special class of unitaries called Clifford unitaries. We're going to make measurements of the Z component of spin, so a Pauli measurement. And there's a beautiful theorem by Daniel Gottesman and Kanil, which says that such quantum circuits with Clifford unitaries and measurements of Pauli operators can be efficiently simulated on a classical computer, and efficiently simulated in polynomial times in the number of qubits, so one can access up to 1,000 qubits or even more. So this is really quite remarkable technology, which I had been largely unaware of, but it's quite standard in the quantum information field. So let me just very briefly run through how this works. So let me first talk about Pauli strings, then stabilizers, and then code words. So I'm going to denote Pauli operators for a single qubit as X, Y, and Z, also, of course, as the identity operator. Now, a string of Pauli operators for L qubits is written here. A particular string is the first qubit is in the identity, the second qubit, the operator is the Y Pauli operator, then the X Pauli operator, and so forth, up to the Lth Pauli operator, which is Z. So little g is how I'll denote Pauli string operators. Now, what about stabilizers and code words? So a pure state psi is called a code word state if it is, quote, stabilized by L independent commuting Pauli string operators. Now, to be stabilized by a Pauli string operator, it means that that state psi, the code word state, is an eigenstate of the stabilizer with eigenvalue 1. So let me just give you an example of how this works. Let's take the simplest state we can imagine, psi, which is just all the spins up. So that's stabilized by a set of Pauli, a set of stabilizers, GJ, for the jth spin, which are equal to ZJ, the Pauli operator. The second example is a little bit more interesting. Here, one has a two qubits in a Bell pair state, and you can convince yourself that this Bell pair state is stabilized by two stabilizers, as it needs to be. The first one is Z1 times Z2 for the first and second qubits, and the second stabilizer is X1 times X2. And if you act with either G1 or G2 on psi, you get back psi with eigenvalue 1. So these are stabilizers and code words, which are eigenvectors of stabilizer operators with eigenvalue 1. What about unitary dynamics, which is what we're interested in? Well, we're going to focus on Clifford unitaries. So Clifford unitaries are a special class of unitaries which, when they are conjugated on a Pauli string operator, take that Pauli string operator into a single other Pauli string operator. So UG, U dagger goes equals G prime. Now I should emphasize, if you just take a generic unitary operator and you conjugate a Pauli string, you will get on the right-hand side a sum over many Pauli string operators. So the Clifford unitaries are special in that they map basically one Pauli string operator under unitaries into another Pauli string operator. And this feature is very nice because it means that if we are undergoing Clifford unitaries, Clifford unitary evolution of a code word state, rather than following the state itself, we can follow the dynamics of the L stabilizers. So in particular, if psi is stabilized by a set of stabilizers G sub J, then psi prime, which is equal to U times psi, where U is a Clifford, is stabilized by a set of stabilizers GJ prime, which is given by U, GJ, U dagger. So rather than following the Hilbert, the wave function with 2 to the L complex coefficients describing it, we can follow L Pauli string operators and how they evolve under unitary evolution. And there's a tremendous simplification. And you might have thought we were throwing out the baby with the bathwater and we would end up with, losing all interesting quantum entanglement and so forth, but that appears not to be the case. What about measurements and stabilizers? Well, I've talked before about making a projective measurement of the Z component of spin, let's say the jth spin. And so so we want to make a projective measurement. We start with a code word, which is stabilized by a bunch of stabilizers G sub J. And after projective measurement, it goes to P plus psi, plus or minus, depending on the outcome of the measurement. Now, if ZJ anti-commutes with one of the stabilizers, you can make it so it commutes with all the other stabilizers, G2 to GL, by appropriately multiplying stabilizers together. And after the projective measurement, the stabilizers are modified. G1 to GL, which are the stabilizers before the measurement, go over to plus or minus ZJ G2 to GL. So basically, since ZJ anti-commutes with G1, the stabilizer G1 is replaced by ZJ, which is the Pauli operator that we're measuring. Here, the plus or minus corresponds to the result of the measurement, which we choose randomly given by Born's rule. Now, stabilizers are useful because one can relate them in a rather simple way to entanglement. So in order to describe that, let's define the stabilizer length. So a stabilizer length here is a 10-qubit stabilizer, and it has length 6 because that the first 2 qubits and the last 2 qubits are in the identity. And one can relate the entanglement entropy of some region A, a contiguous region A, with regions B and C, by counting the number of stabilizers which have one end of their stabilizer in A and one end in C, or one end in B, excuse me. So if I denote the number of stabilizers that start in A and end in A, B, and C as NA, NB, and NC, it turns out that the entanglement entropy of A, big A, with B, with the other regions, is given by little nb plus nc divided by 2 times log 2. Now, this factor of 1/2 is half what one would get for the entanglement of a Bell pair. But we've already seen that to stabilize a Bell pair, one needs 2 stabilizers. And so each stabilizer, in some sense, contributes 1/2 of the entanglement entropy of a Bell pair. So in some sense, Bell pairs are divided into 2 stabilizers. In any case, this is a very useful and interesting formula, which is reminiscent of counting entanglement by looking at Bell pairs crossing boundaries, counting Bell pairs crossing boundaries. Okay, so now what I want to describe is some specific numerical simulations on on what we call the hybrid Clifford circuit. So the hybrid Clifford circuit is all 2-qubit unitaries are taken from the Clifford group. So these blue boxes are 2-qubit unitaries taken from the Clifford group. All single-qubit measurements, these white dots, which occur with probability P, are taken from the Pauli group. And in this case, we're measuring the Z component of the spin. And as I say, we're making measurements with probability P. We choose to make a measurement at any given space-time point with probability P. And Yaodong Li and others have simulated such Clifford hybrid quantum circuits on classical computers with very large numbers of qubits. So here's some results from the numerical data. What has been done is one started with a pure initial state. It could be a direct product state, but it doesn't so much matter. One runs a circuit for long times, and then looks at the entanglement entropy of the qubits at long times, either computing the entanglement entropy using the way I've just described or with other methods that one can use. And what's plotted here is the entanglement entropy versus LA, the size of the subregion A, on a log-log plot. And the curves up here, which on a log-log plot have slope 1, are for weak measurements or infrequent measurements, and they exhibit volume law entanglement. On the other hand, if we make many measurements, as we already argued, that we expect area law entanglement, and what it looks like, we have some sort of phase transition separating the volume law entangled phase from the area law entangled phase, where this black curve is probably, you know, right near the phase transition, the critical value of PC. So this data seems to be consistent with an entanglement phase transition separating the entangled phase for P less than PC from a disentangled phase with P bigger than PC and a transition at some critical value of P sub C. This was done simultaneously by Li Chen and myself and Skinner, Ruman, and Naum. It's useful to try to identify and locate this transition a little more accurately. And one way to do that is to use the mutual information. So as we'll see, mutual information locates the transition. So what is a mutual information? Well, you take your system. In this case, it's a periodic system. So the system of qubits is on a ring. And we consider two subregions, A and B. And in this example, LA equals LB equals L over 8, where L is the circumference of the ring. And the mutual information is essentially a measure of how big the correlations are between A and B. In some sense, how entangled A and B are, but not precisely so. So it's given by the entanglement entropy of A with everything else, the entanglement entropy of B with everything else, and then you remove the entanglement entropy of A and B with everything else. Now, what would one expect for this entanglement entropy in the two phases? Well, in the area law phase, when we make many measurements, the entanglement entropy is an area law, and so the only entanglement one gets is across the cuts at the ends of the regions A and B, and in the mutual information, those cuts get canceled off, so one would expect that the entanglement entropy in the area law phase the mutual information in the area law phase should be very small, essentially zero. In the volume law phase, one also expects that the mutual information should be zero because the entanglement of A is volume law, the entanglement of B is volume law, and the entanglement of A and B is a volume law given by volume A union B, and that is cancels off SA plus SB. And right at the critical point, as the numerics shows, and these are numerics on the Clifford circuits, is that the entanglement, the mutual information is equal to some non-zero value. And as one makes the system size bigger, 64, 128, 256, 512, this peak here sharpens up. And this gradual sharpening of a peak indicates that this transition, the entanglement-disentanglement transition, is presumably a second-order phase transition or a continuous phase transition. And when one has a continuous phase transition, one can use the methodology of scaling to try to collapse such curves. And that's what's shown here. So this is the same set of data replotted, mutual information on the vertical axis, and on the horizontal axis, one's plotting P minus PC times L to the 1 over nu. But one has a set of different system sizes, L, running from 64 to 512, and they all collapse onto the same curve, provided one chooses this critical exponent nu correctly, and the best fit that one gets here is nu is 1.4. So that's a critical exponent. One can look also at what the entanglement entropy looks like right at the critical point at P equals PC. And what is found from the Clifford numerics is that the entanglement entropy versus LA on a semi-log plot is a nice straight line. So basically what this tells us, and this data tells us, is that the entanglement entropy is given by some coefficient times log L sub A with some presumably universal prefactor here. Now, an entanglement entropy which grows as a logarithm of the subsystem size is what one finds in the ground state of a 1+1-dimensional conformal field theory. But remember, we're not dealing with a 1+1-dimensional conformal field theory ground state. We've got a hybrid circuit out of equilibrium, you know, driven through measurements in unitary evolution. Nevertheless, the transition itself looks, right at the transition, the entanglement entropy has this log dependence which resembles the conformal field theory. And this suggests that maybe there's some underlying conformal symmetry at the critical point in this hybrid circuit. Well, it turns out that if one has an underlying conformal field theory, one can show that the mutual information we've been talking about before depends on, is just a function of what's called the cross ratio eta. So here the region A runs from x1 to x2. This circle is again the system, the qubits on a periodic bounding conditions. B runs from x3 to x4, and eta is related or defined in terms of x1, 2, x3, 4 divided by x1, 3, x2, 4. This is called the cross ratio, where on a when the periodized xij is basically the distance between xi and xj made periodic. And so what Yao Dong did is computed the mutual information in this setup by varying the locations and the lengths of the two regions A and B, and you collect a lot of data that way, and you take all of that data for the mutual information, and you plot it versus the cross ratio. And what you find is that all of the data collapses onto a unique curve, which is what one would expect if one has an underlying conformal symmetry at the critical point. So that's quite remarkable and suggests that there's a real structure there at this measurement-induced quantum transition. Now, the quantum transition itself is interesting, but so is the volume law phase. And what I want to do is give you two arguments that the volume law phase might have a background logarithm. So here, I've in fact written that in the volume law phase, there's a piece of the entanglement entropy which is linear in LA, and I've shown a background logarithm. Well, how can we argue that there might be such a background logarithm? Well, there are two arguments. One uses Clifford numerics and what are called stabilizer distribution functions, and the other involves mapping to a statistical mechanical model and looking at entanglement domain walls computed with what we call capillary wave theory. So let me first talk about, excuse me, the stabilizer distribution function in the Clifford numerics. So here, so d of x is the stabilizer distribution function where x is the length of the stabilizer. And there are three panels here. The left one is for p less than pc, that's in the volume law entangled phase. P equals pc, that's right at the critical point. And p greater than pc, that's in the area law entangled phase. And what you can see is that when you're in the area law entangled phase, the stabilizer length distribution function cuts off at long distances and fits to an exponential, e to the minus x over xi, where xi is some appropriate correlation length. At the critical point, if you ignore the finite size piece of the curves here, the curve here on a log-log plot has slope 2, and so one has that the stabilizer distribution function falls off as 1 over x squared. But what's surprising is that in the volume law entangled phase, in addition to a peak here at distance L over 2, which we call long stabilizers, and they're the stabilizers which contribute to the volume law entanglement, there's a background, there's a background piece here which looks like at the critical point, and that background piece is seems to be fit to a 1 over x squared, just like it is at the critical point. And it's this 1 over x squared, like we have at the critical point, which leads us to have suggested that there's a background logarithm in the entanglement entropy in the volume law phase. So you can basically come back to this picture where we're looking at the entanglement of region A with regions B and C. We have this expression that we simply need to count the number of stabilizers which have one end in A and the other in B, or one end in A and the other in C, divide by 2 and multiply by log 2. And if we know the stabilizer distribution function, which we've now measured with Clifford dynamics, one can do a double integral, putting the one end x1 inside a region A and x2 outside region A. And a double integral of a 1 over x squared, when you integrate 1 over x squared twice, you get a logarithm. And so that accounts for the logarithm of the entanglement entropy right at the critical point, and also gives us a background logarithm subdominant to the volume law entanglement in the volume law entangled phase. Now, I should mention that if one takes a random wave function, a completely random wave function, it's volume law entangled with maximum coefficient of the volume law entanglement. But if you take a Hamiltonian for some spin chain and look at the eigenstates, which are at finite energy density, but not, not right in the middle of the many-body band. So those finite energy density eigenstates are volume law entangled with a reduced coefficient of the volume law entanglement. But for those states, those eigenstate entanglement curves, one does not expect a background logarithm. So this background logarithm is intimately connected with the fact that we have a system with a hybrid circuit where measurements are being made. Maybe I should ask whether there are any questions up to this stage.
Yeah, Matthew, there's some, I think, pretty important questions maybe that you want to say more about. One of them is from Joshua Heath. He asks, can a transition between entangled and disentangled phases be seen explicitly in certain condensed matter models? So in particular, maybe you can discuss the relation between these type of phase transitions with MBL type transitions.
Yeah. An MBL transition, it's really a many-body localized transition, is also a transition from the many-body localized phase to the thermal phase, is a transition which occurs in the nature of the eigenstates, and in particularly the entanglement properties of the eigenstates. So in the many-body localized phase, the eigenstates give one an every law entanglement entropy, whereas in the volume law phase, the eigenstates give one a volume law entanglement entropy. So there is some, I would say, superficial similarity between the entanglement thermal transition that one has in a disordered condensed matter quantum spin chain, let's say, and what one has in these hybrid quantum circuits. Does that answer the question? I think.
Yeah, so Reihua Fan has an interesting follow-up question on that. He says, while the MBL thermal transition is on a unitary system, the transition here is not. So is it possible to realize this type of universality class in a system with unitarity?
With only unitarity?
Right.
I don't believe so. I think the measurements are pretty critical. And I think the answer is no. I mean, I think one needs to be making measurements to do this. I mean, I think one could find this this transition with a unitary evolution on a spin chain if one were making projective measurements at some discrete set of times of the spins on the spin chain. That would be, a way to mimic these hybrid quantum circuits which have unitary evolution and measurements. But So this transition here is really only present in a monitored system, which involves measurements and unitaries.
Okay, thanks. But before we get to Leo's question, I think there was another important question from, Daniel Potts and some other people. So they're basically asking about, let me try to find it. So Daniel asks, can't master equation type dynamics also be modeled with quantum trajectories where the Lindblad operators act as quantum jumps? Can we still see measurement-induced entanglement phase transitions in this case? So I think he's basically referring to like a density matrix point of view.
Yeah, I mean, I think if one looks at the evolution of the density matrix in, let's say, a Lindbladian approach, where one is not observing the system and notating the results of the measurements, one's not going to get such an entanglement transition at all.
These quantum trajectories are, in some sense, quantum jumps as well. I mean, things are discrete because we're on a discrete model. But really, one needs to be following here the wave functions. I mean, one can write down a pure state density matrix and follow the pure state density matrix, but that's equivalent really to following the quantum trajectories of wave functions.
Okay, thanks. So Leo, you can go ahead and ask your question.
So I was wondering how important is the protocol according to which you choose the projected wave function? Like you choose it according to the probability distribution itself, according to the density matrix. But what if you always chose up? Would there, or some other protocol, would you still have a transition, or how different would it be?
I think you would still have a transition, at least in the Clifford circuits, because whether you find up or down, which occurs with 50% probability, and if it's up or down, the entanglement still disentangles.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. I think you can continue, Matthew.
Okay. Good. Thanks. So yeah. Thanks for the good questions. I hope I could help a little bit. So we were talking about the background logarithm in the volume law entangled phase, and one can argue for such a background logarithm by trying to do some analytic work. Mapping these hybrid quantum circuits to a statistical mechanical spin model. This is not my work. This is work by these authors here. For the unitary circuits, there's been a number of maps to statistical mechanical spin models, but these two papers are looking at mappings in these hybrid circuits. And in brief, what they do is, rather than considering random Clifford circuits with projective measurements, they consider random Haar circuits with sort of generalized what are called weak measurements. So a random Haar circuit is here, the two qubit unitaries are taken randomly from the Haar group from U4, basically, so that it's, you know, a bigger set of unitaries than the Clifford unitaries. And the reason they took this model is because it's analytically mappable, if you will, to a spin model. So in particular, what they were able to do is map this Haar circuit model to some sort of generalized Potts model, where the Potts spins, which are generalized Potts spins, live on the space-time manifold of the circuit. And in order to do this mapping, they had to use replicas, and so the spin model has a replica limit, so it's really quite complicated. A full access to the phase transition is not possible, although there are certain limits in which one can say certain things.
I should say that the in this circuit, when you run it for time t, the qubits appear at the end of the circuit at that final time. And in these mapping to the POTS model, you have boundary conditions on these final qubits, which are fixed in the directions of the POTS spin A and fixed in the direction of POTS spins B. Whereas they're free spins, you know, to be summed over in a statistical mechanical model. So think of this as like some sort of Ising model, if you want to think about it that way, a two-dimensional Ising model, two-dimensional classical Ising model. And so just as in the two-dimensional classical Ising model, one expects two phases, an ordered or ferromagnetic phase and a disordered or paramagnetic phase. And you can make an equivalence between the phases in the stat-mech model that the volume law phase corresponds to the ordered phase of the stat-mech model, and the area law phase corresponds to the disordered phase of the stat-mech model. And not surprisingly, the critical point, the entanglement transition critical point, corresponds to the phase transition in the stat-mech model. And one can understand some things about the entanglement entropy from the statistical mechanical model. In order to do that, one has to relate the entanglement entropy to some feature of the statistical mechanical model. And so if one has the circuit here, and this is the final time, and it's in this blue region where the pot spins live, if one considers a region A where one wants to calculate the entanglement entropy, what one needs to do is change the boundary conditions on this spin model, pretend it's an Ising spin model. So you want to make upspin boundary conditions and downspin boundary conditions on the regions outside of A. And that will need to, if you're in the volume law phase or in the ordered phase of the spin model, you will then be required to put in a domain wall separating the downspin phase from the upspin phase. And so in the volume law phase, which is the ordered phase of the spin model, you get the free energy is just the free energy of the domain wall, which is proportional to the length of the domain wall. And so the entanglement entropy, which is equal to the free energy of the domain wall, is equal to L sub A. In the area law phase, which is the paramagnetic phase of the spin model, changing the boundary conditions from downspin to upspin on the boundaries leads to just a finite free energy cost, basically coming from the endpoints. And so the entanglement entropy, which is the free energy cost for changing these boundary conditions, is of order one. It's just coming from these points x1 and x2. And so that's the area law phase. So I just want to come back to the background logarithm in the volume law entangled phase. So if the system is in the volume law entangled phase, which is like the ordered phase of the spin model, there will just be one domain wall going across this region A, and S sum A will be the domain wall free energy. Now the domain wall free energy has two contributions. It has the energy of the domain wall, which is the surface energy of the domain wall, which is equal to the length of the domain wall, L sub A. But this domain wall can also have transverse fluctuations, which lead to the entropy of the domain wall and feed into the reducing the free energy of the domain wall. And so one can actually work out using what I call capillary wave theory, an expression which describes the basically transverse fluctuations of this domain wall, where y of x parameterizes the domain wall. This is some Gaussian theory, and one can do the functional integral exactly to calculate this capillary wave partition function and the capillary wave free energy. And one finds, as I say, the energy piece and the entropy piece. And the entropy piece is given by log L sub A. There's a three halves here, which we think would be universal. this three halves was identified by Fan, Vijay, and Vishwanath, and you. And as I say, they used a slightly different method, but it was also mapping to some effective spin model, basically an Ising model in that case. Okay, so now I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about what happens if we take the Clifford circuit and we start with a mixed initial state. And this is some really beautiful work by Michael Gullins and David Hughes. So what they did, they started the dynamics in a maximally mixed state. So the density matrix is proportional to the identity. And here they looked at the not the entanglement entropy, but just the entropy. The entropy of a maximally mixed state is maximal. So the entropy at time zero for these qubits in the initial density matrix is L log 2. They then run the Clifford circuit, and they the density state matrix stays fixed, but they nevertheless are taking, when they make a measurement, they choose a result of the measurement based on the Born rule and then proceed from there. So they're not summing over the measurement outcomes, they're notating the results of the measurements. And when you do that and run the Clifford circuit, the maximally mixed state slowly becomes less mixed. And the mixed state, as it becomes less mixed, has fewer stabilizers than qubits. So here one has M stabilizers with M less than L being the number of qubits. And the missing stabilizers are, you know, giving one the space of the mixed state density matrix, and the entropy, the thermodynamic entropy is given by L minus M times log 2. So initially, they don't have any stabilizers. They start with a maximally mixed state, and so M is equal to 0. But measurements can increase the number of stabilizers, thereby decreasing the entropy. So basically, one has a very maximally mixed state. One starts making projective measurements and pulling out entropy. You know, one's lowering the entropy of the system by looking at it, essentially, by measuring it and notating the outcome of those measurements. And the way that works is, you know, from Clifford rules and Clifford dynamics for mixed state density matrix. If you're measuring the Z component of spin at site J, and that commutes with but is independent of all of the stabilizers, then you add ZJ to the list of M stabilizers. So you take M to M plus one. So if you measure a Pauli spin, which commutes with all of the stabilizers, that reduces the entropy. And what they were able to do, which is quite remarkable, is to then identify a purification transition in this hybrid Clifford circuit. So they run the Clifford circuit from the mixed state, the maximally mixed state at time zero, they run the circuit out to times of order L, and then they compute the thermal entropy at time T, trace rho T log rho T. And what's plotted over here is their data. When P is less than PC, PC is 0.16, they have a finite entropy density, and this they call the mix phase, since the density matrix is still mixed. Over here, when they make enough measurements, they go into what they call the pure phase. And in the pure phase, even though they started with a mixed state density matrix, you've made enough measurements that eventually the system completely purifies and you end up with just a wave function that's running on that circuit. So you start with this very mixed density matrix. If you make enough measurements, it purifies it completely, and you get a pure state density matrix with a single wave function, which then continues to stay pure at later times. And they found then there's a phase transition from the mixed phase to the pure phase, and the mixed phase to the pure phase, again, the mixed phase is the phase where there's finite entropy, so there's still entropy left. The pure phase, the entropy has all been sucked out by these measurements. And so they identify what they call a purification transition. And the location of this purification transition and other arguments indicate that this purification transition is in fact equal to and the same as the entanglement transition. The main difference is the initial conditions of the qubits before you start running the circuit. In the entanglement transition, we started in a pure state, and you stay in a pure state, you follow the quantum trajectories. And in the purification transition, you start in a maximally mixed state with a very high entropy, and then you run the circuit. And in the phase where the pure state evolves into a volume-low entangled state, the mixed state remains mixed and with an entropy which is positive. So how much time do I have? I guess I have about 10 minutes.
Yeah, a little bit more, like 13 minutes.
Okay, 13 minutes. Okay. All right, well, now let me discuss how you can view the mixed phase, the mixed phase here, in terms of a quantum error correcting code. And I describe this with some trepidation, since I'm not a quantum information theorist, even though I'm doing my best to try to learn some. But let's see if I can describe what a quantum error correcting code is, and what, in particular, a stabilizer quantum error correcting code is. And then I'll turn to the quantum error correcting codes that are generated by these hybrid circuits. So a quantum error correcting code, and the nice example is Shor's 9-qubit stabilizer quantum error correcting code, embeds what are called logical qubits, 0 bar and 1 bar, in physical qubits. In this case, there are 9 physical qubits. So 0 bar, which is like the logical qubit being up, is written in this way. And 1 bar, the logical qubit being down, is written in this way with minus signs. And I should say that in the toric code, I think a number of people, Shea and John McGreevy, mentioned that the toric code is some sort of quantum error correcting code. There, the logical qubits are string operators which run around the two circles of the torus. And the physical qubits are the number of qubits in the entire two-dimensional plane of the toric code. So Shor's 9-qubit code is a quantum error correcting code. It's a stabilizer code, excuse me. And these codes are specified by 3 integers, L, K, and D. L is just the number of physical qubits. That's simple. K is a number of logical qubits, which for the Shor's code, K is equal to 1. And L minus K is a number of stabilizers. Because since there's 1 qubit, logical qubit, which is not stabilized by the, in this case, there are 8 stabilizers, they don't fully stabilize a unique state. They stabilize a state which is spanned, a part of the Hilbert space, which is spanned by A0 bar plus B1 bar. So one has these 8 stabilizers stabilizing this code space. And in addition to those, there are what are called logical operators. The logical operators are operators, Pauli string operators, which commute with all of the other stabilizers, with the 8 stabilizers. And when they act on the logical qubits, they act like Pauli matrices. So for example, if you take this X bar logical qubit and you act on 0 bar, it turns it into the state 1 bar. It's like flips the spin. And likewise, Z bar either gives you a plus or minus 1 when it acts on these logical qubits, the basis states of the logical qubits. So these are logical operators. So coming back to LKD, physical qubits, logical qubits, and D is the code distance, and it's essentially the shortest logical operator. And if you look at these logical operators, they look like they're length 9, but if you multiply them by one of the stabilizers, which you're allowed to do, you can shorten them down to length 3. So for the Shor's 9-qubit code, the shortest logical operator D is equal to 3. And The logical operators in the toric code are operators which basically run around the waist of the cylinder or of the torus and act to cause transitions between basis states of the logical qubits. So the code distance for the toric code is basically the number of qubits that you go around the ring or around the shortest cycle in a torus. And it turns out that the code distance is a shortest logical operator. So a code with distance D can correct any error acting on D minus 1/2 arbitrary qubits. So with a D equals 3, the short codes can correct an arbitrary single qubit error. So now what I want to do is come back to these hybrid quantum circuits and, as with Gullens and Hughes, run the circuit starting with a mixed state, running it, but remaining in the mixed phase, so making infrequent enough measurements to stay in the mixed phase. So it's convenient at time at the initial state to purify the mixed state by introducing a bunch of ancilla qubits. These are ancilla qubits, or reference qubits, R, by writing down a wave function psi of Q of R, which when you trace out the reference qubits, you get the maximally mixed initial states on the system qubits. And then you evolve the system qubits, and you just leave the ancillas alone. You don't evolve them at all. And after a time t, you end up with an LKD quantum error correcting stabilizer code. Here, L is a number of physical qubits. K, which is the number of logical qubits, is the entropy of the code space. So that's equal to trace rho t log rho t. And M, which is L minus K, is the number of stabilizers. So you can define a code rate, which is the ratio of the number of logical qubits to the number of physical qubits. And in these quantum error correcting codes dynamically generated with the hybrid circuits, these code rates are constant, or non-zero. But what about the code distance for these dynamically generated quantum error correcting codes? What about the code distance? Well, you can get the code distance from a rather nice decoupling theorem, that Yaodong Li was able to prove for stabilizer states. If you define L sub A to be the number of logical operators that can be localized on subsystem A, the theorem he was able to show was that L sub A, which is an integer, is equal to the mutual information between A and R. R, remind you, are the ancillas, the reference qubits, and A are the subset of the physical qubits. So this is the mutual information. And now recall that the code distance D is the shortest logical operator. So if your subsystem A is smaller than D, then you can't get any logical operators in subsystem A because they're too long. And so L sub A is equal to zero, which implies that the mutual information is equal to zero between A and R. And that implies that the reduced density matrices rho AR decouple. And so sort of physically, the subsystem A decouples from the environment if A is smaller than D, and the environment gives no information on the subsystem A. So how do you get this code distance? Well, there's different ways to get the code distance for the Clifford circuit, but one way is to compute the mutual information between A and R. And if you look here, A of R versus L sub A, you have this region where A of R, the mutual information is this, very small, essentially zero, and that gives you an estimate of the code distance. And if you look as a function of the size of the system L, the code distance scales with an algebraic with L with a power of around 0.38. We can also get the code distance from the entanglement domain walls. So it turns out, and I don't really have time to do this in too much detail, but if one's looking at the entanglement entropy of a region A bar, which is a conjugate complement to region A, there are two competing domain wall configurations. This one here, in which the A is large enough, the mutual information is positive, and a domain wall configuration here where the mutual information is zero. So A and R essentially decouple, and sort of physically, in order to pass from A to R, you have to go through two domain walls. And so they're kind of decoupled. Whereas to go from A to R, over here, you have to go through one domain wall, no domain walls. So the mutual information is positive. Anyway, suffice it to say that you can use capillary wave theory, which I described earlier, to compute the mutual information as a function of LA, and you get a curve which looks the same, essentially the same as the Clifford numerics, so that's nice. And we can pull out from capillary wave theory analytically the code distance. And the code distance of capillary wave theory varies as logarithm of the system size, and actually disagrees with the Clifford numerics. And so this is something which is puzzling to us and which we don't understand. Okay, what I want to do now, just to finish up, is to talk about the elephant in the room. I mean, I've been describing, some what I think is, fairly interesting theoretical exposition. And the question is there any experimental access? Well, we've seen that, and I've argued that in order to access the transition, you have to follow the quantum trajectories. You have to basically make the measurements, notate the result of the measurement, and then, evolve with unitarity, and then make another measurement, and so forth. Now, the challenge with this is to extract the entanglement entropy or other observables requires multiple copies of the same wave function. So normally, like if one wants to look at the entanglement entropy, one needs, the second Rényi entropy, one needs two copies of the identical wave function. But the problem is here is that when one makes the measurements and runs a circuit, each time through the circuit, one will find different results of the measurements, and someone will end up with a different state at the final time. So in order to reproduce the same state, it requires post-selection on all of the L times T measurement outcomes, choosing among 2 to the LT possible random outcomes to get a copy of the state psi. So this becomes prohibitively difficult when you have a reasonable size circuit, or even not even such a big circuit. So how can one overcome the challenge? Well, there are a couple of proposals by Chua, Bao, Altman, and Gullins and Hughes. And a piece of Gullins and Hughes' proposal, I think, although I don't really fully understand these proposals, so please don't ask me about them, is that one can imagine on a quantum computer using Clifford circuits. And with a Clifford circuit, it turns out measurement outcomes can be forced. So let's say you run the Clifford circuit on a quantum computer and you get a bunch of measurements up, down, up, up, down. And the next time you run the circuit with exactly the same unitaries and measurements, you get down, up, 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 down. So you get different results. Well, so what you want to do is you want to use error correction to correct the wrong outcome of a particular measurement. So you want to use error correction to undo a wrong measurement outcome and then try again. And so in this way, you can make essentially a forced measurement. And this could be the background, the algorithm which one needs to do this can be, worked out on a classical computer using stabilizers. So then if these Clifford gates can be implemented on a quantum computer, one may be able to access some of this physics of this entanglement transition. And so let me just wrap up. So I've been talking about this quantum entanglement transition on these hybrid quantum circuits, which have unitary dynamics and measurements. There are also interesting circuits that you can write down which have just measurements only, non-commuting measurement operators, which have transitions as well. In fact, Tim Shea has looked at one or two of those, which are quite very interesting. But here we've been looking at transitions between volume law entanglement and area law entanglement, or between an impure state and a pure state when one's starting with a maximally mixed initial state. Now, you know, in contrast to many of the, you know, very nice lectures early in the week, which were, you know, based on, you know, fairly well established, you know, theoretical and experimental results, you know, what I've been talking about is work, you know, collectively, which is rather in progress. And so there are really a lot of open questions. And I'll just mention a few of them here. There's a question of the universality class of the transition in the one-dimensional hybrid circuit. You know, mapping to these spin models, but these are replicated spin models, and so it's not clear how to analyze those. Talk about the role of randomness. You know, we've put randomness into three different places: randomness in the unitary gates, randomness in the locations of the measurements, and randomness in the outcome of the measurements. But it turns out you can eliminate with these Clifford circuits two of the three types of randomness, keeping just the randomness in the measurement outcomes, and you still get an entanglement, disentanglement transition. So we're not sure what the role of the randomness is. It certainly helps analytic calculations, but it may not be critical in having the phenomenology. What about higher dimensions? You know, focused entirely on, one-dimensional qubits, you can ask about higher dimensions. We haven't considered feedback at all, but many systems in quantum information theory, one, and in quantum computer, you consider feedback. You make a measurement, and depending on the outcome of the result of the measurement, you do either one unitary or another unitary. So it interested us how these are connected with systems of feedback. And other phases of quantum error correcting code. So these, you know, hybrid circuits generate dynamically a particular class of quantum error correcting codes, but there may be other classes of quantum error correcting codes. And, you know, equivalently, there would be other phases of quantum computers that could be run into these quantum error correcting codes. You know, other dynamical phases in general in monitored open systems. And then, you know, the elephant in the room is the experimental observation of the entanglement transition, which, you know, hopefully in quantum computers using Clifford gates, there may be some progress that can be made on that. So, okay, well, I think I've run out of time. So, thank you so much for your attention. I appreciate those of you who stuck around to the bitter end of to the afternoon here on Friday.
Okay, thanks for the nice talk, Matthew. We only have like 6 minutes till the Q&A, so let's just maybe just address one question for now in this session. So this is from John McGreevy. He asks, might Leo's question help with the problem of seeing this experimentally? That is, instead of choosing outcomes with the distribution specified by the state, could we just project onto spin down each time we are supposed to make a measurement?
Yeah, but how do you do that?
I think he's probably imagining like applying like a big field to polarize the spin, but that would be a unitary operation.
That's a unitary operator. To make a projective measurement to project to spin down, I'm not sure how to do that. I mean,
right.
You can measure it, and if you find it spin down, that's great. If you measure it and find it spin up, then you can kind of correct that and measure it again, and then hopefully it'll be down. So that's... on our computers, we can make a measurement to just, you know, project it onto spin down. On the circuits, we could do that. But I think in the lab, I don't see how that's possible. But maybe you have to think about that more.
So actually, about this point, you mentioned that the Clifford circuits can be kind of, the measurements there can be forced. Yeah, so if you have a measurement on like a very low entangled state, I can see that. But if you have a measurement on like a volume law state, that measurement can affect things very far away from the location of the measurement. So is the correction circuit guaranteed to be efficient?
Well, what you have to do, I think, is what you do with error correction, which is in stabilizers circuits, is you have to make measurements, you know, you have a possible error and you have to then make measurements of all the stabilizers. And based on the outcomes of the stabilizer measurements, which are, you know, plus or minus one, you get the syndrome. And then you have to use a classical computer to deduce which measurement, you know, which error you've ended up with. I mean, because you're making these measure, you're measuring the stabilizers. And so, then at the end, you can then fix that error.
Okay, so I think Tarun and Tihua Kha, Tihua Kha, if you could just wait for the Q&A to ask, that'd be appreciated. So let's take a very quick break and return in a couple minutes for the Q&A session. So thanks again, Matthew and Yaodong.